So this evening, I'll be reading from Uncommon Wisdom, Life and Teachings of Ajahn Panyavardho. I'll be reading the chapter entitled Self, which I've also seen this talk entitled The Tornado of Self. Each of us has a worldview built up inside since we were born, informing us about the nature of things in the world. This worldview of ours is like a map located within, which tells us where everything is. We feel secure in this view because we know where we stand in the world and how we should behave in the world. Behind that view is a belief that it represents something real. At the center of it all is our self-identity. Not only do we have a view of how things are now in the present, but we also have a view of how they became like this. In other words, we have views about both the present and the past. We also think we have a view which is projected into the future, telling us what we think things will be like. Our views of the world and our place in them are, in fact, false. The very nature of our self-identity makes them false. Because of that, most of our delusion is located in these views. And the trouble with delusion is that it prevents us from seeing what is real and what is not. So we continue viewing the world in our habitual way, even though our worldview is untrue. Delusion creates our worldview, which includes all our beliefs, our ideas, and our opinions about everything. This information is saved in our memory. We remember things and situations because we crave security. For example, when we come to a new place, we search around to find where the things we need are located. Having found them, we remember where those things are. When we need them, we'll know where to look. And we check our surroundings quite frequently to make sure everything is where it should be. In this way, we update our memory all the time. If something has changed, we question the new order and then we adjust memory accordingly. We always want the assurance that things are more or less permanent. We're always seeking permanence. Permanence in the sense that memory reassures us that things are as they were previously. We have developed an idea of permanence that we superimpose on the world. Then, when our world alters dramatically, we are really upset. The world seems to have suddenly changed, but actually, it has been undergoing change the whole time. Our minds just gave it the appearance of permanence, that's all. As such, we tend to be deluded in the way we see and understand. We go along with that understanding because we crave security. Without that feeling of security, false though it is, we would feel the need to be constantly watchful of everything in our environment, and that would make us feel uncomfortable. Thus, we're always trying to fix and place the world around us, our environment, so that we know it and feel unthreatened by it. We lull ourselves into a false sense of security because we are deluded into thinking that our world remains unchanged when in fact it does not. Everything is constantly changing. Even if we fail to see everything changing, the changes are taking place. We must realize that change doesn't mean just change out in the world. It also means change in ourselves. When we see something from a different angle or at a different time, we see that object has changed, but the change is largely in oneself, the one who sees it. That's the real meaning of anicca. Everything is changing within us the whole time. We remember seeing something, but by the time we see it again, it has aged. More than that, in the meantime, we have learned more about all sorts of things, so internally, the thing is not seen in the same way. It seems to have changed when, in fact, it's we who have changed more. The changes inside us are much more relevant to us than the changes outside. These changes occur in our minds, attitudes, understandings, and so on. Change also occurs in the self that we think is so permanent and stable. This is the area where delusion blinds us to the truth. It's not the case, as many Buddhists believe, that the self does not exist. Actually, a self-identity does exist for all of us, but it's constantly changing and so has no permanence. That being the case, the idea of self is not incorrect, as long as we realize that the self is not a permanent entity. Actually, there's bound to be a self. That's what we all experience. But when we examine it, we'll see that our self-identity doesn't remain the same for two consecutive moments. It's changing continually. The Buddha never said that there is no self. He said that no permanent entity exists that we could call self. In the suttas, it is stated, all things are anicca. What is anicca is dukkha, and what is anicca and dukkha is anatta. This indicates that in the Buddha's time, it must have been obvious to everyone that the true nature of self must be absolute happiness. In other words, if it was not permanent happiness, then it could not be self. Time after time in the suttas, this formula comes up. It must have been taken for granted by the average person at the time of the Buddha in a way that is not by people nowadays. So the relationship between happiness and the belief in self must have been common knowledge. It was this belief that the Buddha was countering with the doctrine of anatta. Whatever is anicca is dukkha, and whatever is anicca and dukkha cannot possibly be the permanent happiness that the concept of self implies. Therefore, not self means that there is no permanent self which equals permanent happiness. Because everything is changing, nothing can be satisfactory. And because everything is changing and unsatisfactory, no permanent self-entity exists anywhere in the universe. The Buddha was not saying that there is no self-perspective in the whirlwind of changing phenomena. He was saying instead that there is no permanent unchanging self to be found. The Buddha said that the self can be body, the self can be feeling, the self can be memory, the self can be thought, and the self can be consciousness. One's self-perspective can jump between any of these aggregates of personality. It is constantly moving about. Our delusion is not so much that we experience everything from a personal self-perspective, but rather that we deny change and cling to the sense of self as real and permanent. Our sense of self is so firmly established that it serves no purpose to deny its existence. On the other hand, as long as we continue to deny change, we will never see the truth of not-self. The delusion of self is completely bound up with the delusion about permanence. The fundamental delusion of self is deeply ingrained, and therefore critical to the way in which we interact with the world. The Buddha calls this delusion manaditti, the idea of I am. I have views, I have ideas, I have thoughts, and so on. In our ordinary interactions with the world, the idea of self is actually necessary because we need a reference point to compare ourselves to other people and to objects in our surroundings. We must have some reference point to function in the world. So our minds devise a self-perspective. That's all right. It's necessary. But then we cling to the very firm belief in the reality of that self and assume it to be a fixed entity. The delusion really starts when we believe in the permanent reality of that self and react from a self-centered viewpoint. We then harbor opinions of ourselves as being more or less exalted, as being right or good or entitled. What are those ideas attached to? They're attached to our views of self, a self which is virtually an imposter. At best, we can say that this imposter is a necessary evil, but it's not a true thing, so the whole basis of our thinking is delusional. Ignorance and craving are the factors that create the delusion of self-identity. They create the delusion that we exist in relationship to something else, meaning a self must exist in relation to what's not self. The kilesas convince us that what matters is the advantage to self, and they do whatever they can to promote a strong self-image. Ultimately, the troubles we experience are all caused by believing in that self. When there is self, there is also that which is not self, and there is a relationship between the two. In the relationship, that which is not self defines self, and that which is self defines not self. The two sides work together. Without not self, the self just disappears. It means nothing. Not self must always be there, always pointing to self, to I am. The belief in an immutable entity is the background to the idea of self, the idea that the self has a fixed, independent existence. The self exists. Everybody has a self-identity. But the self is an endless series of changing phenomena that whirls about continuously, forever changing appearance like a chameleon. It's not that self doesn't exist, but that it's a bundle of dynamic change. So we cannot pin the self down and say this, it is this, or it is that, because as soon as we pin it down, it immediately becomes different. Because of that, the eternalist belief in an immutable entity is quite wrong. If something is entirely unchangeable, that must be Nibbana. Nibbana is certainly not an entity. Where we have entities, we have comparisons between different entities. When we have comparisons between entities, then those entities must be impermanent in order to exist. The nature of existence can be expressed as a paradox. We can say that the fundamental characteristic of existence is constant change. Existence depends on change. At the same time, anything that changes is not real, because it does not last. The fundamental characteristic of reality is permanence. Thus, the paradox. What exists is not real, and what is real does not exist. Reality and existence cannot, therefore, be coincident. The world of our sensual experiences is an aspect of existence because nothing remains the same from one moment to the next. Nothing we experience is fixed and immutable. All is flowing and changing. Nibbana is the one permanent reality that does not change. So we can say the self exists because it is constantly changing. Most people misunderstand the Buddha's basic teaching on anatta. But Buddha's conventional wisdom has it that there is no self. But truthfully speaking, we cannot claim that we don't have a self, since we've already created it. It's there. We refer to it. That reference, in fact, brings it into existence and maintains it. The self-perspective exists, but certainly there is no entity of self, no permanent self. The personal self is merely a product of delusion. I visualize the self like a whirlwind or a tornado. It comes buzzing across the plains, whirling violently, creating havoc, and damaging everything in its path. But when we examine it closely, we find it is only air and nothing else. And when the air stops whirling, where is it? We can't find it. It's gone. In other words, there's no substance there. There's no entity to be found. Its existence is merely that whirling, that dynamic movement. The self is very much like that, a whirlwind of changing phenomena driven by mental defilements. The self is a reference point, and that reference point is created by the kilesas. Actually, we talk about self in terms of subject and object. When we sense things, there is the one who senses and the one that sensed and the thing that sensed. We see things. There's the thing that's seen and the one who sees it. We say, I see that, having assumed that there is some self that sees it. I hear it or I think it. A self perspective is always coming into our experience, but in each case, a different self arises. The self that relates to seeing is not the one that relates to hearing. The one that relates to external senses is not the one that relates to thinking or to memory, etc. With each new mental state, a different self arises, a different reference point, and every reference point is bound up with kilesas. Bad states of mind obviously involve the kilesas, but good states of mind also involve kilesas. Like fish in water, we are so immersed in kilesas that we never know any other perspective. Just as fish know only the experience of water, so we have no idea what life without the kilesas is like. Because they're always there, we know only their side of the story. Their side of the story is the fiction of individual personality, the imposter that we call self. The self is a very elusive thing, because it's shifting about all the time. We seek confirmation of its objective reality. A lot of our thinking is done for just that reason. In fact, it's the reason we do so many things, the reason why so many of the kilesas get involved. The self is an illusion that the kilesas conjure up to push their way on us. Since I have a self, I should know who I am. To know who I am, I must have objects and people surrounding me to tell me who I am. Views, attitudes, and emotions also help define who I am. I am this type of person. That is, the type of person I believe myself to be. I may appear very different to other people, but I hold to the belief I am this type of person. I wish to reinforce that belief, so I act in ways that I think that type of person would act, and often make a fool of myself in doing it. If we could just drop the idea of self, we would be all right. Here, I am not saying that we can just drop it like that. We can't. People can't just drop self. If they drop self in one way, they just pick it up in another way. The only positive action we can do is to work on the meditation practice, cultivate sila, samadhi, and panya, until the mind develops wisdom. When the mind develops wisdom to a sufficient level, the dropping of self-identity will happen automatically. There will be no need to actively try to let go. When the deception of self is clearly comprehended, the desire to cling to a self-identity will drop away on its own. Letting go of self-identity is not like giving up cigarettes, but still constantly craving them. In truth, a person who gives up cigarettes like that has not given them up properly. As long as the wanting remains, they have not really been given up. On the other hand, the giving up of kilesas leaves no residual wanting behind. It may happen that certain desires have so thoroughly disappeared that suddenly one day you realize, oh, the kilesas don't come up like before. I am not interested in them anymore. The interest has dropped away. This is the way the breaking of attachment should be. It should be automatic and final. It's not so much that the way of practicing meditation is very difficult. It is the overcoming of those things that are blocking the way that's really difficult. In a very real sense, we are our own worst enemies in meditation. We tend to get hung up on all the wrong things. It is not just a matter of doing the right things, but more a matter of going in the right direction. When we go in the right direction, we start uncovering the wrong things that we do and begin to correct them. By going in the right direction, we slowly cut at our delusion. Then we learn not to do harmful actions in the future. The barrier to achieving that, of course, is attachment to our self-identity. In order to breach that psychological barrier, we must give up a part of our precious self. We must accept that, on a certain level, we can no longer make a distinction between ourselves and other people. Most people are not prepared to go that far. By accepting that, we would be forced to relinquish many of our personal motives and ways of behavior. For instance, we couldn't consider other people as enemies, because when no distinctions are made, hating others is equivalent to hating ourselves. Also, it isn't that we destroy the self through meditation, but that we come to understand that the self is an illusion. No destruction of self takes place because there's nothing to destroy. It's rather like trying to destroy a shadow. Seeing through the illusion, on the other hand, reveals the mind's true nature. Fundamentally, the element of Nibbana is there within us already. It must be there. If it wasn't already there, we couldn't possibly reach it, because Nibbana is not subject to arising. The Buddha stated that very clearly, that whatever arises must cease, which means that Nibbana must be there within us all the time. Otherwise, it would have to arise at some point, which is incompatible with its nature of being unchanging. This is the true nature of Dhamma, the Dhamma in the heart. The heart always experiences a pull in the direction of Dhamma, but its pull is not like the pull of the kilesas. It's not like the pull of the child who must have a sweet right now. That's the pull of the kilesas. The pull of Dhamma is a longing to get back to something that we know is real. It's a longing to go home, in the true way, where everything is just right. In the end, following the way of Buddhism back to our true home means giving up all attachment to our ideas of self. Our journey home begins with examining all of our attachments in the light of these three marks of existence, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca is impermanence, constant change, the tendency for nothing to last. Dukkha is discontent, dissatisfaction. We see that everything is always changing, nothing lasts long. We get something that seems very good, and before long it's gone. That's not a basis for lasting contentment. And that which is changing and unsatisfactory is anatta, because it cannot be a basis for a viable self. How can there possibly be a self in what's changing and unsatisfactory? When all is changing, the self does not remain the same for two consecutive moments. The way of Dhamma is to realize that this is the case, that all of existence is characterized by these three marks, nicca, dukkha, and anatta. Seeing those in a profound way cuts away our defilement, or cuts away our attachments. Seeing those marks clearly, we won't experience attachment to anything because how can we be attached to something which doesn't last? As soon as we grasp it, it's gone in the same moment. It's like trying to pick up water with a sieve. It just falls straight through. That which we call self and think of self is bound up with the delusion that we exist as individuals in this world. That which is Dhamma appears to be something other, something outside the domain of self, but something which can come and help. Like delusion, Dhamma also resides in the mind. The two exist side by side in the mind. Delusion is the factor that creates a sense of duality and then tries to secure that perspective in place. Because of that, we experience nothing but pain and suffering. No matter how tightly things seem to be fixed in place, those things always undergo change because they are anicca. So we suffer because the one we think of as self is constantly trying to resist the inevitable. That one, the self we think we are, can never know the truth. That which appears to be other is the truth. While the self cannot help us to realize the truth, the other, which is the truth, is not really separate from us at all. We must learn to recognize that within us there is both the truth of Dhamma that will always tell us the right way to go, both in terms of which actions are morally right and wrong, and in terms of which meditation techniques are best suited to countering delusion. We must learn to trust the voice of Dhamma within us. The more we trust it, the more its power grows within us, and the closer we come to reaching our true home.
Before, did you get a chance to spend much time with Ajahn Panyarawada?
No, I've met him over the years, but I never got to spend much time with him. I never really spent much time with, say, like at Baba.
Near the end of the talk, you first like the voice of Dhamma inside. Could you say anything about the voice of Dhamma versus like the voice that we hear inside of our head?
I would say if he's you say voice of Dhamma, then that's probably more like say referring like oftentimes in Thai idiom they say the one who knows. That kind of quality, in the sense of the Dhamma is the orienting factor, as opposed to just kind of some kind of random proliferation, even if it's around Dhamma.
I was kind of thinking maybe if it's like you have like the angel in each shoulder, like one saying like I should go to bed now, and the other one's like maybe you should walk another hour.
Right.
Could that be seen as like the Dhamma voice is the one that's potentially...
That would be a way of expressing that sense of, there's that thing. Maybe that sense of conscience or sense of care, circumspection, that keeps us on track.